This podcast has been endorsed by the Vasculitis Foundation. You are listening to a UNC Kidney Center podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Falk, the director of the UNC Kidney Center. Our goal is to help you better understand your kidney disease. We have a patient here today who's interested in learning more about the treatment of ANCA-vasculitis. This patient has a vasculitis of her own. Welcome, Diane.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, and I'm looking forward to talking with you about these treatment issues. So let me just open with, I have recently, as you know, been diagnosed with ANCA-vasculitis. What kinds of medicines am I going to need to take?
Treatment can be thought of in several stages that we need to talk about during the course of this podcast. The first part of treatment is really induction therapy, the therapy you get when you're first diagnosed. That kind of therapy must be matched with the intensity of your disease. The more intense, the more severe the disease, the more induction therapy you need. The less intense, the less severe, you might get away with less potent therapy. But for the most part, patients with these kinds of vasculitis need quite substantial induction therapy, and by that I mean pulses of glucocorticoids, known as pulse methylprednisolone or pulse solumedrol, usually given for 3 days, or to remove the ANCA, to remove the antibody with a technique called plasmapheresis. That's where your blood is removed from you and then returned, but the antibody, the ANCA, have been removed from the circulation. Those treatments typically are done over the first 2 weeks of diagnosis, and that usually gets rid of the antibody load. Then the induction therapy includes oral prednisone or prednisolone, depending upon what part of the world you're in, and usually induction therapy includes some kind of cyclophosphamide or Cytoxan.
Are there any investigational drugs that people can start with, or is it always the Cytoxan?
All of us are trying to get rid of cyclophosphamide or Cytoxan because it has so many nasty long-term consequences. But early on in the course of the disease, for the first 3 months, for example, cyclophosphamide remains the gold standard therapy. There are investigational drugs, including antibodies to B cells or drugs that you use to get rid of B cells, that are being thought about as part of induction therapy. But in reality, our current induction therapy with solumedrol and or plasmapheresis and cyclophosphamide for the first 3 months results in remission rates in 3 to 4 months of almost 85% to 90% of patients. It's a very effective induction approach. The problem comes how to stop or slow down the use of the glucocorticoid or the prednisone and when to stop the cyclophosphamide. That's really where all of us have been moving in terms of our thinking about treatment.
So how will I know and how will my physician know when these drugs are working? You say there's an 85% remission rate. How do you know that someone's in remission?
The whole question of remission and what constitutes remission is actually a really interesting and difficult question. It would be wonderful if there was a marker, a blood test that you could use and know for sure that the person was in remission or not. And those blood tests, even ANCA tests, don't really help us fully. So I think of somebody in remission who has no active disease in the organ system or the part of the body where their disease was mostly manifest. So if your disease was in your lungs, then I would want to make sure that your lungs were clear on a chest X-ray or even yet on a computerized or CAT scan of your lungs. I would want to make sure in your kidney that the kidney function was improving, was stabilized, that the amount of blood in your urine was gone or almost gone. Protein in the urine is not a good marker for remission. You know when your nose is healing. You know when your nose is active better than we do. So some of these are symptoms. How well does the person feel? The problem is nobody feels hugely well on cyclophosphamide, ever. And so how much of how people are actually able to do is a combination of how active their disease is, the side effects of the drug, and just healing from the autoimmune process itself. So your question is complicated. How do we do it in practice? I like to make sure that the organ system involved doesn't have active disease, that there are no new symptoms, and there are formal ways of doing this with a vasculitis scoring system, and I try to make sure that there are really no things to score. There's no evidence of any active disease. That's really remission.
So once your disease is under control, does that mean that that I'm finished with therapy?
That would be wonderful if that was true. Most physicians will use cyclophosphamide for 3 to 4 months. If the person is in remission, all of us seek other kinds of drugs that are less toxic. Those drugs include azathioprine or Imuran, methotrexate, or more recently, mycophenolate mofetil, otherwise known as Cellcept. During those first 3 or 4 months, all of us try to get rid of or at least reduce significantly the amount of prednisone, so that by month 3 or 4, one should really be on a substantially reduced dose. Now, in some patients, I will tell you that at 6 months of therapy, if remission is maintained and there's no evidence that the person has had a relapse, we can have stopped therapy in some patients, watching those patients neurotically. So stopping therapy is easiest if you have a neurotic patient and a neurotic doctor. And you and I have talked about this before. If the patient and the doctor have a good relationship and you look for signs of recurrent disease, then stopping therapy is much safer. So, for example, in the kidney, if you're worried about recurrence of the disease, you can take home dipsticks that you can urinate on and see if there's blood or protein in your urine. If there is no blood, why, your chances of having a relapse are, in the kidney at least, are reduced. But in many patients, we continue some kind of immunosuppressive drug, remission maintenance drug, for a period of time. And how long one needs to remain on those remission maintenance drugs is very much due to or a consequence of the patient's disease, how active it's been, whether it's relapsed, or in fact, whether it's a patient whose disease is just not going to come back, in which case the drugs can be stopped earlier.
You mentioned some side effects. Can you tell me about the side effects that I might experience with these different drugs?
Prednisone's the worst. Of all the drugs that I hate, which you hate as well, prednisone or prednisolone are the most complicated. And they cause infections. They cause softening of bones and cataracts and glaucoma. They can cause irritation to the pancreas. I have never met anybody who has an easy chance of losing weight on prednisone. People gain huge amounts of weight. And it's weight in places that you really don't want the weight to be demonstrated. It causes hunger. It causes irritability. It causes people not to sleep well. So the drug that I try to get down to the lowest possible amount, if not stop, in fact, is prednisone. Now, that's controversial. Some people think that prednisone may help prevent remission, relapses. The evidence for that is still pretty weak when one thinks of the side effects of these drugs. Cytoxan is a nasty drug. You know that as well as I do. It certainly can cause life-threatening infections. It has an increased risk of cancer, and you need to do cancer surveillance if you have been on Cytoxan. Is irritating to the bladder, can cause bladder bleeding, less so if you use it by vein. And there's no question that we're trying to all decrease the exposure to Cytoxan. There are a couple ways of doing that. One, to give it by vein, you use about half the dose if you use Cytoxan by vein. And you should know I'm interchanging the words cyclophosphamide and Cytoxan. If you do it by mouth, if you give the drug by mouth, it's easier for the patient to take. There's a higher risk of bleeding from the bladder. And you use twice the amount of drug over the course of the same amount of time. So if you have 3 months of oral cyclophosphamide, that's about a month and a half of giving it by vein. So the cumulative dose with oral cyclophosphamide builds up very quickly. And there are adverse consequences of that. So you need to make sure that your physician is eager to either give you cyclophosphamide by vein or reduce the length of time you're on it by mouth.
How long can a person be on Cytoxan? What's a sort of upper limit for that, or is there one?
There's not an upper limit per se. There are some people whose disease is so severe and relapses so horribly that Cytoxan is required. The number of those patients at this point in time is actually very, very few. We've now seen way over 1,000 patients, and the number of people who I have remaining on oral Cytoxan for a long period of time, I probably can count on my fingers, and I still have 10 fingers, so now that's probably all that we have. The hope, of course, is to decrease the exposure by switching to another drug or combination of other drugs.
I've heard of people losing their hair who experience a lot of nausea when they take Cytoxan. How common is this?
When giving it by vein, we usually use some kind of medication that decreases the nausea. So when you're getting the drug by vein, you will have some nausea more than likely. That typically goes away in 2 or 3 days. Taking it by mouth, nausea becomes a real problem. Nausea is also a problem, quite frankly, if you take methotrexate for a long period of time as well. Nausea is a side effect of Imuran as well. It usually requires a dose reduction. So the gastrointestinal tract is unfortunately is a common place for these drugs to become manifest. Losing hair is less of a problem if you reduce the dose or the duration of time that you're on Cytoxan. The number of people running around with artificial hair has mercifully declined over the course of time just because we are using so much less Cytoxan than days of old. The real problem with oral Cytoxan has been the risk of ovarian failure in young people, especially, for example, people in their 20s and 30s who are on oral Cytoxan for a long period of time. Ovarian failure is really a worry and something that we try to decrease the chances of ovarian failure with drugs such as leuprolide acetate or, in fact, again, just reducing the dose and the duration of therapy.
Is there something that I can do to decrease my risk for infection when I'm taking these drugs that are suppressing my immune system?
Wash your hands. Wash your hands again. Most bugs are transmitted from hand to mouth or hand to nose. It's important to avoid people who clearly have another infection. So during flu season, it's very nice to keep those people away from you, keep away from people who are sneezing or who have viral diseases. But many people just can't escape these opportunistic kinds of infections. So we worry about tuberculosis. We worry about fungal infections. But the most common thing are viral diseases. And you can avoid those to a certain extent by good hygiene.
Can taking these drugs cause anemia?
All of these drugs, cyclophosphamide, mycophenolate, mofetil or Celcept, and Imuran, all pressure the bone marrow. And by pressure, I mean can affect any number of cells within the bone marrow, including cells that become blood cells that become white blood cells that become platelets. That part of your circulating a cell that stops you from bleeding is a platelet. So cyclophosphamide therapy, mycophenolate, mofetil therapy, and azathioprine all can cause an anemia. To a certain extent, what you'd like to see is that the dose of the drug is decreased as long as one can remain in remission. But there are ways of boosting the bone marrow to produce more red blood cells there, drugs that are what are called erythrocyte-stimulating agents, the erythropoietin drugs that can be used. But yes, many of these immunosuppressive drugs cause anemia. The first goal is to decrease the dose, if at all possible, and then to use erythropoietin drugs if needed.
So am I at risk for bleeding if I take aspirin every day along with these other medicines?
I think taking a baby aspirin, 81 milligrams of aspirin a day, is good for most older individuals. And by older, it's probably over the tender age of 50. I think that if you take an aspirin of that little dose, you shouldn't have real bleeding problems. But I've seen patients have increased bruising on 81 milligrams of aspirin a day if they're taking a lot of prednisone. So you may have to cut that aspirin in half, quite frankly, if you're developing bruising with prednisone and aspirin. And certainly aspirin's not good if you're substantially anemic. In other words, your hemoglobin has fallen either because your disease is active or because of the drugs. There's one place that aspirin therapy must be stopped. If you're having bleeding from your lungs for any reason, aspirin must be stopped, or aspirin must be stopped if you're having an invasive procedure, a kidney biopsy, or any kind of test which involves putting a needle into some place that has a propensity to bleed.
What kinds of tests or monitoring should I expect when I'm undergoing treatments?
You need to always make sure that you have tests that tell you or help your doctor tell both of you whether you are in remission or are having or about to have a relapse. So typical kinds of tests are tests of some kind of inflammatory monitor like a C-reactive protein or a sedimentation rate. Those are very nonspecific. We do follow ANCA titers because in some individuals, a negative ANCA titer, an ANCA that goes away, really is much more correlative with remission. And if the ANCA titer starts to increase again, you worry that the disease is coming back. There are lots of patients in whom, however, the ANCA titer remains persistently elevated, and in those individuals, the ANCA titer is not as good of a test. You want to make sure that the urine has no blood in it or few red blood cells. You want to make sure that kidney function is stable. So that would be a serum creatinine test that then is converted to an estimated glomerular filtration rate. You want to make sure that if you had lung disease that lung function tests or x-rays are used. And the most complicated place in my mind of monitoring is the upper respiratory tract. Is the nose infected? Is the nose have active disease? Are sinuses infected or is there vasculitis in the sinus? And you know that's an incredibly complicated question for your ear, nose, and throat doctor to figure out. And I would hope that people listening have, if they have upper respiratory tract disease, have a very careful, compassionate ear, nose, and throat surgeon who is going to take the time to really look in the nose, understand whether a person has infection or disease activation, and sometimes, as you know, it's the combination of both, and spends the time really examining the upper airways. It's the upper respiratory tract that is so difficult to figure out if there's disease activity or not.
Can we talk about flares a minute since we're talking about monitoring? How do you know when you're having a flare, and what should you be doing as a patient?
Another fantastic question. I think patients know when they're flaring. I think patients are almost always correct. The problem is for patients and then for their doctors is the flare a little flare, a big flare, or a consequence of diminution or reduction of the medication? So let me give you an example. You've had a disease where your joints were involved as part of the initial disease process. And now on steroids, on prednisone, your joints are feeling wonderful. Now, of course, if I put most people on prednisone, their joints would feel great. Every little place they've hurt would nicely get better. Remember, the folks that won the Nobel Prize for prednisone won it because they thought they had cured rheumatoid arthritis. When you come off of prednisone or the drug, the dosage has been reduced, every place that you've ever hurt before, every joint, every tendon, is suddenly going to start to hurt a bit again. That's not a flare necessarily, but that's just reduction in the dosage of medication. So many times the conversation I've have with patients is, as we're reducing the dosage of prednisone, does this remind you of your disease activity, or does this remind you of a nagging injury that you've had for years? That's a conversation that you have to have with your physician. But again, patients know if their disease in their joints is affecting multiple joints in the same way that it bothered them when their disease first started. How can you tell if you're relapsing in your nose or sinuses? I think you, again, can tell us as patients, listen, this is exactly how my nose bothered me when it first started. And you use wonderful words like meteorites and kabooms or kablams that come out of your nose. That's when you have to have an ear, nose, and throat surgeon really look at your nose. I'm starting to cough up blood again. That would make me worried about disease relapse. So all the things I'm telling you are recrudescence of symptoms, which patients always know earlier than their doctors. With respect to the kidney, looking at dipsticks can tell you if blood is coming back way before you see it macroscopically. But this is where a patient-physician interaction and mutual understanding is so important. If the physician is not willing to interact with you on a regular basis, if you're worried about flare, and their response is, oh, I'm just going to increase the dose of the medicine you're on, or I'm going to start prednisone back, without this kind of dialogue, it's time to have a face-to-face, heart-to-heart chat with your physician. Because the physician should be able to say, yes, you're right, you are having a flare, or at least I think you're having a flare, and we should increase the dose of medicine. Or if they should be able to say, you know, let's wait for a few more days and let's see what happens, and I'll see you or I'll talk to you again. So to me, the ability to take people off of medications, to stop all therapy, is really contingent upon my willingness and the patient's willingness to have lots of interactions by phone, by seeing each other, by email. And to comfort both of us, the doctor and the patient, that we're moving in the right way together. And of course, if it's a full-blown flare, that becomes pretty easy. But you and I have talked about fatigue before. I think fatigue is a symptom that lasts for years, even if patients are otherwise in remission. You know a lot about fatigue.
I do. I know that when I am able to reduce doses of drugs, I suddenly feel the surge of energy. I think, oh, that's what that was like. Most of the time, I do experience a level of fatigue, and depending on various factors, so I just have to monitor my life. And I think of it as an energy bank, and to make a withdrawal, you have to make a deposit. You have to take naps. You have to think about what you're going to do over a day or in the course of taking a vacation or a business trip. You have to be kind of self-monitoring. And also, talking about flares, I think it's really important for patients to know that they're a very important member of the care team. It's not just doctors saying this and that. It's the patient knowing his or her body and being able to say to his or her doctors that I think something's going on, and having that statement listened to and respected and talked through.
Yeah, I mean, that's the critical nature of any chronic disease, but especially this disease where you don't really know. You don't have a hard and firm measure of relapse in many patients. So the dialogue you're just describing is absolutely critical. I think patients remain on drugs at higher doses or the doses are increased when this conversation is not a two-way street. I think that one is much more able to, as a doctor-patient, patient-doctor relation, to come up with minimal kinds of therapy if there's good communication and both sides are listening. The people who remain on drugs forever at high doses typically have not found a doctor-patient relationship that is optimum for them.
I've heard of individualized therapy and how it can help improve patient outcomes by giving just the right dose of just the right medicine. Can you tell me a little about that, and is anything happening with vasculitis?
We have historically dosed patients on the basis of one size fits all. We do that for most of medicine. And what's called personalized medicine or individualized therapy is really here. And the question has to come for any given person: do they need more or less of any particular drug? We're getting a better handle on those genes that, in fact, are responsible for producing enzymes that metabolize many drugs that you're on. Some people have lots of enzymatic activity, and you give them a drug and they metabolize it or chew it up with incredible speed. Those individuals need more drug or more frequently administered. Then there are patients who have very little enzymatic activity and the drug stays along forever. Exactly how this fits with, for example, Cytoxan therapy or mycophenolate mofetil therapy is actually being studied in vasculitic patients right now. There are a lot of factors. Some of it may be your genes, some of it may be what you eat, some of it may be what other drugs you're taking. But individualized therapy should decrease the number of side effects of most of the drugs that we use.
I'm concerned about the long-term effects of being on all these drugs you've talked about. People can be anemic, that you're at risk for certain cancers. Can you talk a little bit about these long-term effects?
I am too. I share that view. As a matter of fact, physicians who have these diseases invariably take themselves off of drugs more rapidly than almost any other group. So it always interests me when physicians want to prescribe these drugs for the long haul, when if they themselves were on this kind of immunosuppressive therapy, they would want to be off of the drugs as fast as possible. The principle that must be used is the question of how long do I have to use any drug? What's the evidence that I need to still be on any of these immunomodulatory drugs? If my disease is going to flare, if I have a high chance of flaring, if I flare, I'm really going to have severe organ damage, then there's a better reason to stay on an immunosuppressive drug, but you should be on the lowest possible dose that keeps you in remission. I think as all of us are moving forward, the question has to be, what is the evidence in me that I have to remain on any drug? If I monitor myself carefully and I can pick up an early flare, can that flare be gotten back under control? Can I stop medications? That's the era that we're in. if one has to remain on immunosuppressive drugs long term, remember, if you suppress your immune system, you have a higher chance of having cancers. And then if you have to remain on drugs of this kind, you have to do cancer surveillance at a more intense and more frequent basis than you would have to do if you're off of these medications. So the overall strategy for everybody is, let's get people off of these drugs. If we can't, let's come to the lowest possible dose of the least toxic medicine available. The era of endless use of drugs should only be reserved for those people that have shown that they have to be on long-term immunosuppressive therapy.
So I'm young and would like to start a family someday. Does a Cytoxan cause sterility in some patients?
Cytoxan absolutely can cause ovarian failure in women and probably loss of sperm in men. In patients with lupus, another kind of autoimmune disease, the National Institute of Health looked at the side effects of Cytoxan and ovarian failure most carefully. And in their series, they had many women who had ovarian failure. The same was true in the National Institute of Health studies with Wegener's granulomatosis. So in some case series, up to 40% of people on long-term oral cyclophosphamide can have ovarian failure or premature loss of ovarian function. In other words, menopause early on. The goal of avoiding ovarian failure are two things. One, if one has to be on Cytoxan, to use it for the shortest amount of time possible, or to essentially put one's ovaries to sleep with a drug called luprolide acetate or Lupron, which has to be used before Cytoxan is started. And again, to use the smallest amount of drug, again, probably by giving it by vein rather than by mouth, just to decrease the total exposure to Cytoxan.
And if you're male, should you think about sperm banking?
Excellent question. Absolutely. Before you ever receive Cytoxan, if you're a male, you should bank sperm. And probably more than just one time in an effort to really make sure that there are plenty of sperm available for in vitro fertilization.
And if you're a woman, there is IVF now. Should she consider that as well as the Lupron, or, will the Lupron be enough?
Lupron has been pretty effective. The problem with Lupron is that most patients don't have the time to get Lupron or, quite frankly, to get eggs harvested before therapy is started. So to a certain extent, the severity of the disease is triggering rapid use of Cytoxan, making much more difficult these protective strategies. So the best approach is, as soon as the disease is under control, to decrease the amount of Cytoxan or to stop it and substitute it with another drug.
Well, I think that's all the questions I have. I want to thank you so much for taking time today to talk with me about all of these issues surrounding treatment for vasculitis.
Well, I want to thank you because you've asked wonderful and very difficult questions, and I hope our listeners can think of other questions that they might want to have us respond to. But again, thanks for your time.